since well, there will be some sort of a web page for this class, not a wiki, because this is too much work labor for me. Okay. So the web page will be drovien.net/sh17. SH for summer homology, 17 for the year. Okay. Yeah, I'll set it up later today. It will be up in probably less than 2 hours. Okay. Right, and also somebody reminded me that I failed to tell you about the most important category. In fact, I failed to tell you about the two most important categories that we will play with. So the category here is, or this diagram is written in a certain category, and that category is called the category of topological spaces. So this whole diagram is written in top. Okay? Top is the category whose objects are topological spaces and whose morphisms are continuous functions. Okay? This is written in the category of abelian groups. So this is written in another category that I didn't mention, ab. So abelian groups mean commutative groups. So it's a subcategory. I never quite defined what a subcategory is, but it's a subcategory of the category of groups. Instead of taking all groups, you just restrict your attention to abelian groups. Okay. But then I told you that the whole point is to somehow find, I told you what a discipline is. A discipline is sort of a category. And then a functor should be a map between disciplines. So let me formalize it. So I want to define what is a functor. So suppose you have two categories. What does it mean to have a functor between them? So first category, let's call it C. And I've erased the definition, but I hope you still remember. It's a collection of objects. It's a collection of morphisms. As there is a special identity morphisms, there is composition. And then there are some laws. So composing with the identity does nothing. And composing with the, composition is associative. Okay? Now suppose I had the second category. Let's call it calligraphic D. So it has its own objects. So it's a collection of objects of D. It has a collection of morphisms between objects in D. It's something else, right? It has the identity, it has composition. Okay? So definition, a functor, F going from C to D. So basically I'm defining what this will be. Okay? Is the following collection, again, it's a lots of structure. It's a lot of stuff. Okay? So first of all, it's a function, but we're not in set theory, so it's not really a function, it's a map of, it's some generalized notion of function, but forget it. So let's think about it as if it was set. So set. So it's some function f that takes objects in C to objects in D. I also want to take morphisms from C to D. So how does it work? So if A and B are both objects in the category C, I have a function which I will also denote f. So sort of I use the same symbol f to denote many different things, and you should understand from the context which one it is. So here f denotes a functor. If I apply f to an object, it produces an object. If I apply f to a morphism, it produces a morphism. So f should, so given two objects in C, if I have a morphism in C from A to B, then f should produce for me a morphism from the image of A to the image of B. So here's the picture. First part of the picture is drawn in the category C, and the second part of the picture is drawn in the category D. So if I have an object A in the category C and an object B in the category, also in the category C, and suppose I have a morphism between them, what should we call it? Psi. Okay? So think, this is really a space, this is another space, this is a map between them. The functor should produce the same kind of thing in the target space, in the target category. So in the target, I already know where to push objects, so I'll have FA, it will go to FB via a map that I will call it F psi. Okay? So F should be an operation that takes psi to F psi. So it takes morphisms from A to B to morphisms from F of A to F of B. So it goes from morphisms in C from A to B to morphisms in D from F of A to F of B. Okay? So actually that's all. I mean, that's all in as much as structure is concerned. But now I have to give you axioms such that the following is satisfied. Such that. One, it's, I think, only two axioms. So the identity gets mapped to the identity. So if you have the identity of some object A, so that would be a morphism in the category C between A and itself. Then its image via F, so F of the identity A, the identity of A, so first of all, what is it? So since the identity was a morphism from A to A, F applied to it would be a morphism from FA to FA. So that would be a morphism in the category D from FA to FA. And the axiom is, well, we already know a very good morphism from FA to FA, namely the identity in the category D. So the axiom is that this should be the identity of the object FA. Okay? And then the second axiom is that F preserves compositions. So I could write it in great detail, but instead, and it will be very messy and very confusing, just as this was messy and confusing. Okay? But in fact, it's much simpler than that. Because what does it mean to preserve compositions? It means that if you have three objects, A, B. So first of all, what does composition mean? Composition means that if you have three objects, A, B, and C, maybe I'll draw it this way, then and you have psi from here to here, you have phi from here to here, then the composition is psi followed by phi. And this is a commutative triangle. And then the axiom is that F will map it again to a commutative triangle. So what does F do? It takes a space in one subject, so in topology, to a space in algebra. So A will become F of A. B will become F of B. C will become F of C. Now, the map psi will become the map F psi. So again, if that was a topological space, if psi was a continuous function, then that might be a group homomorphism, okay? The map phi will become the map F of phi. The map psi composed with phi will become F of psi composed with phi. And the condition is that if this triangle was commutative, so if this was a composition triangle, then after applying F, the result is still commutative. So sort of this commutativity is given, and the commutativity here is the condition. So I put it, I'll put an exclamation mark to indicate that's the part that I'm insisting on. Okay? Now, if I wanted to write it in full, well, I would have to write lots and lots and lots of letters, okay? But the key point would be the following. The key point would be, you know, maybe I'll start a new blackboard. So the key point is that if you apply the functor to psi followed by phi, the result is doing this. So it's F of psi followed by F of phi. Okay? And that's all. Examples. What examples do I know? Do I know any examples? Probably do. Yeah, okay, so let me give you a few. Let's start by let's start with some stupid examples. Okay? Yeah, okay, so example number one is the forget functor. Okay? It's the functor that tells you forget some structure. So let's give two examples of a forget functor. So one from top to set. Well, if you have two topological spaces, if you have a topological space, it's a set. Just forget the topology and it's a set. So it takes objects in the category top to objects in the category set. Also, if you have a morphism between topological spaces, namely a continuous function, well, a continuous function is in particular a function, so it gives you a function between sets. Similarly, there is a forgetful functor from groups to sets. You just, you know, a group homomorphism is in particular a function. And you know, all of this fancy language is completely obvious, right? That if you compose two group homomorphisms, you actually compose the underlying functions. So all of this is completely stupid. Example two is not in the formal prerequisites of that class. Okay, but I'll do it anyway, because this isn't the formal class. So example two, here is a new category that I haven't talked about yet. So it's topological spaces with a point mark in them. So the objects here, you know, as I'll be more loose with my notation. So I'll just tell you what the objects are. The objects are pair X, which is a topological space. And if you don't like topological spaces, you can think metric spaces, right? And some point P, which is a point in B, which is a point in X. So the object, so the objects, instead of being simply a topological space, it's a topological space with a marked point. So a thing here looks like a space with a special point in it. And B stands for base point. So we will think of it as base point. Well, to turn it into a category, I have to tell you what the maps are. So I have to tell you what are the morphisms. And again, I will be loose, really, when I say, okay, you know what, maybe I should be so loose. So I'll just say in words, what are morphisms? So morphisms will be continuous functions that map the base point to the base point. So if you have X with a base point and Y with a base point, the rule will be X goes maps from X to X, which maps from X to Y, which maps the base point to the base point. So the morphisms are continuous functions preserving the base point. Okay? And surely you have all seen, not all, sorry, some of you have seen the fundamental group of a topological space. Okay? So, I claim that there is a functor called pi 1, and the functor pi 1 is a functor from the category of pointed topological spaces to the category of groups, and it's defined as follows: pi 1 of a pointed topological space, so pi 1 of an object is sorry if it's a self-equality. It's just pi 1. But also, if you have a, so if you remember the definition of fundamental groups, given a function between topological spaces, you get a homomorphism between the corresponding groups. Why? Basically, if you have X and you have Y, and each of them has a base point, and you have a continuous map from here to here, then what's an element of the fundamental group? An element of the fundamental group is just a path. You can always push the path forward. So in fact, often the name of the functor in this case is the push forward functor. So you can push forward this path to a path here. And that's a map between, a homomorphism between the fundamental groups. And do I want to give you another example? You know what? Yeah, that's enough for now. Okay. Okay, so going back to this picture, now everything makes sense. Okay, so the only thing that changes is that I can remove the quotes from the word functor, and really the functor I want is a functor from top to, well, not all groups, but abelian groups. Okay? The moment you construct such a functor, which also has the property that Hn minus 1 of Sn minus 1, so the functor is called Hn minus 1, and if you apply it to this topological space, you get Z. The moment you have such a functor, sorry, and Hn minus 1 of Dn is the zero group, the group with only one element, the element 0. The moment you have such a functor, then a diagram like this in top would become a diagram like that in a billion group, in a billion groups. There is no diagram like that in a billion groups. Therefore, there couldn't have been a diagram like that in top. Therefore, there is no retract. Therefore, the Brouwer fixed point theorem holds. That's the sketch of the proof. So, two more things, or a few more things. First of all, pause for pictures. Oh, sorry, I forgot. Again, this is not a formal class, but one thing that I always do in formal classes is take a group photo. If you want to take a group photo, I'm open to this idea. Okay. So, two more things. One is I want to give an example where this machine works. Example you already know. And the other is I want to sketch what the rest of the four meetings will be like. Okay? So the example is the example of n equals 2. So we already did the case of n equals 1. Okay, the case n equals 1 was the intermediate value theorem. Okay? So in this situation, n equals 1 was the intermediate value theorem. N equals 2 already can be proven using this idea, using take the functor, the missing functor, the functor we want, to be precisely the functor written here, pi 1. Okay? To be pi 1, and actually, strictly speaking, the target will be groups instead of abelian groups. But that doesn't matter, the picture remains the same. So, indeed, one of the first things that you learn, if you learn about a fundamental group, is that pi 1 of S1 is equal to Z, and pi 1 of a contractible space, or a simply connected space, is equal to 0. So pi 1 will map S1 D2 S1, this is the identity, this is the inclusion, this is the missing retract, okay? It will map it to Z goes to 0, goes to Z, where this is the identity, because pi 1 is a functor, so it maps the identity map to the identity homomorphism. But this doesn't exist, and we're done. Right? You cannot map Z to Z via 0. Okay. This will fail in dimensions higher than, if n is greater. So if you wanted to do the same in one dimension up, so S2 goes to D3 goes to S2, well, the fundamental group of the sphere is trivial. Every path on the sphere you can contract to nothing, okay? So therefore, you get 0 goes to 0 goes to 0, and there is no contradiction here. Basically, all the maps could have been the zero maps, have to be the zero maps, the composition of two zero maps is the zero map, there is no contradiction here. So fundamental group will not work, we need something else. So let me tell you what is homology informally. And the whole purpose of this sequence of talks is to define it formally. So what is H, you know, maybe I don't want to use the same end, so let's say HK. So what is HK of X, where X is a topological space, and as usual, if you know, if you don't like topological spaces, use metric spaces, you don't lose anything. So HK of S is defined to be, well, I'll do it in several steps. It's k-dimensional objects within X that have no boundary. So boundaryless, so objects with no boundary, boundaryless sub, well, what exactly is a, boundaryless k-dimensional sub-objects of X. Well, what does it mean, a sub-object of a topological space? I'll have to define it. That's not obvious, okay? But if you've seen manifolds, think like manifolds. So think k-dimensional sub-manifolds of X, but ones that have no boundary. Okay? Again, to make it a formal definition, I will have to work. Okay, actually, this is a set. I don't want it to be a set, I want it to be a group. And I'll make it a group, or an abelian group, in the most brutal way possible, by basically allowing formal linear combinations. Whenever you have a set, you can turn it into a group by just this, by just declaring that you take formal linear combinations. Compared to, every set is the basis of a vector space. You just take the set of all linear combinations of elements of that set. The set doesn't have to have an addition in advance. You just declare the you just declare the vector space to be the set of all sums of elements in the set, formal sums. Yes.
Oh, so is it a coincidence that in the n equals 2 case, like there, it has lots of geometric meaning? Like we think of it as loops, and we can think of it.
Of course, it has no. It's not a coincidence. I mean, all of it has geometrical meaning. I mean, hn minus 1. Right now, it's sort of a silly symbol, but the whole point is that it has some geometrical meaning.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's no black magic in mathematics. Sort of everything has a meaning. No, actually, I'm saying something profound. It's often tempting. It's tempting not just for you, for everybody, for adult mathematicians. It's tempting to read stuff at formula level. But it always has a, if it didn't have a meaning, people would not be able to come up with it. Sorry, I don't know if even if that's related to what you've asked, but it's just something that I feel that I have to say, you know, people should be aware of. People should take note of that.
Okay.
Okay, but that's not the whole thing yet. It's modulo, when you mod out by, again, in the sense of modding out one group by another, one vector space by another, whatever, whichever way you want to think of it, modded out by the boundaries of k plus 1 dimensional objects in X. So if you have a again, if you've seen manifolds, the boundary of a k plus one dimensional manifold is a k dimensional manifold. So boundaries of k plus one dimensional things are subsets, are elements here. So I want to mod out these by those. And this should be a bit unclear unless I give examples. Okay? So, examples. And all of these examples are at an informal level. Because, again, the formalism is what this class is about. It will take, you know, another 4 hours, 4 lectures. Okay? So, let's start with what is H0 of a topological space? So, in other words, if this is X, what is H0 of X? So it's basically zero-dimensional sub-objects of X that have no boundary. Zero-dimensional means single points. So basically, these are the points of X. But modulo the boundaries of one-dimensional objects. What's a one-dimensional object? Think manifolds, okay? So, one-dimensional manifold could be a circle, but the circle has no boundary, so you end up not modding out by anything, okay? But another type of one-dimensional object is a path between 2 points. The boundary of a path is this point minus that point. So if this point is P, this is Q, the boundary of a path gamma is P minus Q, or Q minus P, I don't know. Okay? So I'm looking at all the points of the set X, P, Q, whatever, but I'm declaring that P minus Q is equal to zero whenever there is a path between them. So what do I get? Well, if X is as drawn, namely one chunk, I can connect from any point to any other point by a path, and therefore it's the point of X, but all points are considered to be the same. So it's really one single point, one single generator, so it's Z. Okay? Sorry, when I say, I didn't tell you, take formal linear combinations, I meant over Z. Later it will become clear. If you don't want Z, you can call it F, you can call it R, you can call it whatever your ground field is, whatever your scalars are. Okay? Now, if X has 2 connected components, then this point here is equivalent to that point here, that point here is equivalent to that point here, but there is no path connecting this point to that point, so this point is not equivalent to that point. There is nothing whose boundary is this minus that. So in general, you'll get C raised to the power the number of path components of X. Okay? Okay, let's do now, did I take a picture of this? More than once, I think. Let's take another. Thank you, Mingyao. You sent me an email, thank you. Example. one is going to be a bit tougher. So, you know what? No, let's build up to it. So, what's H1 of S1? Yes? Basically, you get one copy of Z for each connected component. So here you have lots of points. In this connected component, you have lots of points, but they're all equivalent because each pair of points is the boundary of a one-dimensional path. Here you have lots of points, but they're all equivalent because same.
Right. So it's
so really, this you can think of a single point here to be the kind of bearer of everything else. You can think of a single point here, all other points are equivalent to it. So really, the boundaryless k-dimensional sub-objects are that point and that point, and everything else is equivalent to one of those. So you can take arbitrary linear combinations of this point with that point, which is z squared. Okay?
Yeah, and
so basically, you need two coefficients, the coefficients of this point, the coefficient of this point, and the coefficient of that point. So that's z squared. Yes?
Yeah, and they commute, so that's why.
And they commute because that, by definition, I take linear combinations with coefficients in my scalars. It's more like a vector space than like a group.
Right. So okay? That's why it's not the free group.
It's not the free group, right. I do not multiply. I just take linear combinations with scalar coefficients. Okay, good. So H1 of S1. Actually, before that, what's H0 of S1? Well, S1 is the circle. It's connected. Therefore, H0 of S1 is Z. What's H1 of S1? So, without going into too much details, again, the details are what will come later. This is just to get a flavor, okay? So H1 of S1 is, well, can you find a one-dimensional boundaryless sub-object of S1? S1 itself, namely, the one-dimensional object will be the thing itself. It has no boundary. Now, again, in what sense it's the only one, I will have to explain later. But we will have to go through it later. But in some sense, that's the only one. And furthermore, that thing is not the boundary of anything, because if it was to be the boundary of anything, it would have to be the boundary of the inside. And again, I'm being completely informal, and that's not inside S1. So therefore, the answer is Z. Again, I'm giving an intuitive thing that this is really a hard theorem. In fact, somehow, the whole theorem is hiding here, but I'm just telling you, but that's still story level. Okay? Next, what's H1 of S2? So, here is S2. Can you draw a thing with no boundary in S2? Yeah, basically every closed path. So every closed path will be a thing with no boundary. However, every closed path is in itself the boundary of some disk, of some two-dimensional thing. So the answer is zero. Because, right, there are many, many, many things. So by the way, this quotient is generally a quotient of something very huge, very infinite dimensional, by something else very infinite dimensional, but the result is usually finite dimensional. So it's sort of a big battle between sort of big things, but it ends in a small thing. So here, there are many paths with no boundary. Basically, every closed path, this one, that one, I don't know. But all of them are boundaries of this, so the result is zero. Now, what is H2 of S2? So that's more like this picture. There is, again, inside S2, there is a single thing which has no boundary. This is the thing itself. That requires a proof. The proof will come. Okay? But there is only a single thing with no boundary. And it's not the boundary of anything, because if it was the boundary of anything, that anything would be the inside, and the inside is not in. Okay? So the result is Z. And maybe I'll give one last example before quitting for today. So H1 of the two-dimensional torus. So the two-dimensional torus is this. It has lots of things like this one. So this is a one here indicates the dimension. So this is a one-dimensional thing with no boundary. But it is the boundary of its own interior. So this one doesn't count. But there are actually two things that do count. One is the loop going around this way. So this loop has no boundary. And it's not the boundary of anything, because if it was the boundary of anything, that anything would have to go through the hole. Okay? And there is another thing that counts, and this is, these are the loops that go around sort of the bagel the other way. Okay? So such a loop, again, has no boundary, but its boundary is the inside of the bagel, which is not included. Okay? So H1 of T2 will turn out to be Z squared. But again, that's not a trivial theorem. The whole point is to show such things. And maybe I'll stop here. So what we will do tomorrow will be to start with the formal definition. Turn this into a formal definition and then start proving properties. Okay. See you tomorrow.